I'm Carlos Virgen, and this is The Storyline, produced by The Day in New London, Connecticut. This week, we talked to Charlie Clark about the recent controversy over the possible termination of a contract between the town of Ledyard and Ledyard Volunteer Emergency Squad, the town's current ambulance service provider. Julia Bergman tells us about a recent report released by the Coast Guard Academy that looks at various metrics in an effort to measure equity among cadets. And Erica Moser spent time with a Pakistani family from New Britain who are taking sanctuary at the First Congregational Church of Old Lyme as they fight a deportation order. Erica explains what the family's day-to-day life has been like.
So last week, Ledyard Town Council instructed the mayor to send a letter to the Ledyard Volunteer Emergency Squad, which is the town's volunteer ambulance company, informing them that at the start of the new fiscal year, they are not going to continue with the contract that has been in place. The contract that they have has been in place nearly 20 years. The volunteer ambulance company has been responsible for emergency service, is kind of service in town since the 1970s. So it's a huge, huge departure. And what really prompted town council and the mayor to so abruptly kind of take this action is that it came to their attention that the group has had a serious issue with responding to calls on consecutive weekends. They missed the majority of calls that came in, meaning that a mutual aid company from a neighboring town had to come and respond to the call instead, which the concern is that adds more time in delivering, you know, a life-saving service. And then on top of that, their response times when they have been responding hasn't been great. In a sampling of 85 calls, I believe it was, they found that 40% of the time their response took 18 minutes, which you see the divide between their volunteers and their paid staff who work during the day. A paid ambulance company, like their paid staff, makes the response in under 10. So it's a pretty drastic difference, and that's really what prompted them to take this action. I think the question a lot of people had when we started writing is, well, why are they having an issue responding to calls? One, volunteer companies in general can have some issues because your staffing is dependent on volunteers. You can't force them to do anything. And that's not necessarily exclusive to them. I know a while back it came up with the missed call rate in North Stonington as well, although they've certainly made a lot of inroads. I think the difference here is that when you have a volunteer responder, when an emergency calls in and it beeps out to get your volunteer responders, they aren't in the station necessarily. And it seems the case with LVs that a significant portion of their volunteers don't spend their shift in the actual station, meaning they have to come from their home to the station, then respond to the call, or they meet the ambulance at the call. Either way, it would add to your response time in theory, even if you're just 2 minutes away. Well, with a life-saving service, you know, every minute counts. The other thing that kind of informed town council's decision was beyond just the response times, which was their primary concern, was life safety in town, and they didn't want to lose a resident because of this. They also did mention that there were other issues with the group that kind of raised a few eyebrows and had them concerned. Over the past 15 years, there have been 5 different leadership teams. Also, anyone who watched the town council meeting where they voted on this, I don't even know if you could describe it as an open secret that there were clearly divisions within this group, with some members going out and just lambasting former leadership, calling them dictators and things like that. I went to the group's individual meeting last night. Those divisions were still very clear. They voted out one of their members in a divided vote. There were some who didn't want to do that. And this also happened to be a member who was pretty outspoken and being critical of how things had been going and about how really the town council thing should have been a wake-up call. So they're clearly fractured, but they still reaffirmed their commitment last night that they hope to still be the town's ambulance provider. So it seems like they're going to try to respond to the town's request for proposal. I've been told that they've heard from anywhere between three to five different groups that they expect to respond to the request, including American Ambulance and even the town of Groton. So that's kind of where they are going forward. There's also some more stuff going on behind the scenes that we'll be unpacking in the coming weeks. One, their current director, Rick Mumenthaler, he had been a member of the organization for a while. He had stepped away. He literally stepped into a leadership position again as director at the beginning of March after several members of senior leadership abruptly resigned. So one thing he mentioned, and he mentioned this at the town council meeting, is it's going to take us time to get things in order. Sitting at the meeting last night, you know, the town council meeting, they didn't really talk about solutions, which I think worried some councilors for sure. They did talk about some of the things they wanted to do to improve response times going forward. One was, as we kind of mentioned earlier, having people actually spend their shift in the station. That was something that some members were very passionate about, saying we need people to be here. And they actually got some pushback on that. And I think it kind of goes back to, you know, they're volunteers. They're not paid to be there, so people want to spend time with their families and things like that. It can be difficult to get them to spend, you know, an 8-hour shift in the station. But then again, it's a life-saving service and every minute counts, so that would be one area. They're also kind of looking at different things about their shoot time, which is the time a call comes in till actually getting the ambulance on the road. Their professional staff, who there are three paid professional staff who are, they work all 5 weekdays. And it's actually very telling when you look at the data that they are far more proficient. But their shoot time is under 2 minutes. The volunteers are nowhere near that. So that's one area they want to work on getting lower as well. Another thing they talked about is responders coming from home is being more prepared just to get out the door, even if you're spending that shift at home, you know, being dressed in your uniform, having your shoes on, little things like that to pick up time. You know, they certainly seem committed to trying to stick with us, and they're passionate about the organization.
So the Coast Guard Academy recently released a report that looks at a bunch of different metrics, things like enrollment data, retention rates, class pass rates, disciplinary action, those type of things, with a specific focus on equity. And the report follows a year-long process of examining the Academy's own data by the Center for Urban Education at the University of Southern California, which developed this process and tool known as the Equity Scorecard. A number of other higher education institutions have gone through this process. The Academy is the first military service academy to go through it, federal military service academy to go through it. And because of that, certain aspects of the process had to be tailored for them. So the report found a number of inequities, particularly for Black cadets who are less likely to graduate, more likely to receive disciplinary action against them, and are just generally underrepresented in the student body. The data is not extremely extensive. It just covers the past 3 to 5 academic years. And the Academy hasn't been explicitly clear about how they intend to use this data. It doesn't draw any conclusions. And by that, I mean it doesn't explain why these inequities exist. That'll be up to the Coast Guard Academy to decide if they want to take some action to look further into that or develop a plan to respond to the report. Coincidentally, the Academy is actually in the midst of its Eclipse Week, and that's an annual event that actually focuses on diversity, inclusion, and mentorship. And because of that, they told me the superintendent would not be available for an interview on the report, but he did release a prepared statement which basically said the project was part of the Academy's long-term commitment to examine educational outcomes. And he said that they, you know, the Academy will review the data. And identify root causes and examine, you know, policies and practices, he says, and take action to improve them. Some highlights from the report, it found that African Americans, Latinx, which is the gender-neutral term to describe, as opposed to using Latino or Latina, and Asians are underrepresented at the academy when compared to 17 to 24-year-olds in the general population who are eligible for military service. Women are also notably underrepresented. They represent about 33.5% of the class of 2021, for example, compared to nearly 51% in the general population, you know, in that age group who are eligible to serve. These issues are not new to the academy. They've been going on, you know, much longer than the data covers, but the academy has been made some efforts, particularly in recent years, to try to make its student body more diverse and inclusive, and get up retention rates. Some of what is in this report does confirm what some people have said about their experiences at the academy. About 8 months ago, I interviewed some minority cadets there who expressed sort of near constant discrimination and sort of a cultural issues going on there that made the experience there different for Black cadets and other minorities than white cadets.
So Malik Naveed bin Rehman and Zahida Altaf, a Pakistani couple, have been taking sanctuary in the First Congregational Church of Old Lyme since March 19th. That was the date that was scheduled for their flight out of the U.S. as a deportation order. They've been in they came to the country in 2000 on non-immigrant visas, and they had not one but two attorneys who ended up going to prison for fraud. So they were really struggling to, you know, they were trying to stay in the country legally and were really struggling there. They went to Canada for a little while trying to seek asylum. That didn't work. They came back. And then for the past 3 years, they've been visiting immigration officials on a semi-regular basis, and they were able to get worker registration and then Social Security cards. So just in November, the couple purchased or took over ownership of the Pizza Corner restaurant in New Britain. And Malik has been making pizza for years. You know, he's worked at Papa John's and other pizza places in New Britain. So he was happy to, you know, own his own business now. And so the couple said they got the go-ahead from immigration officials to open this business. And then 2 months later, they find out, oh, you're being deported. And they'd been given a final order. A final removal order in 2008, but they just hadn't heard anything. There was never really a date set, so they just continued on with their lives. And at that point, they'd poured thousands into attorneys and had been duped, so they thought, you know, we'll just wait to get an attorney until we hear something. And so then in 2015, when they started going to these regular immigration visits, was when they started getting legal representation again. But yeah, so they were shocked to hear this, and they have a 5-year-old daughter, Zonia, who was born here, so she's an American citizen. She goes to school in Hartford, and so originally this couple's flight had been scheduled for March 2nd, and they had packed their bags, they were ready to go, they were on the way to JFK Airport in New York when they got a call saying, your flight's been canceled because of bad weather. So essentially, if it wasn't for this weather, this couple would be in Pakistan now. Or at least not in the U.S. And then their advocacy team, which is made up of a bunch of students from Central Connecticut State University whose families have been threatened with deportation orders and have been affected by this in some way or another, and this includes one of their relatives who's a student there, this advocacy team basically was pushing for them, saying, no, you can take sanctuary at a church, which is not really an option they'd knew about before, considered before. And this has come up at the First Congregational Church of Old Lyme before. Back in December, they held a press conference announcing sanctuary for Mariano Cardoso Sr. And he stayed in the church one night, and then right before this press conference, maybe an hour before, they found out that he had gotten a last-minute stay. So he was only in the church for one night, so it was hardly taking sanctuary there, whereas now, as I'm recording this, this is the 19th day that Malik and Zahida have been in this church, and, you know, their daughter's staying with relatives who live in Wethersfield and continuing to go to school during the week, and then she visits on the weekend. And so I had first written about this family and their situation on March 22nd. That's when there was the press conference announcing that the church was providing them sanctuary where they'd been since 3 days prior. And then I'd actually also written the article about Mara Narcodoso, who I mentioned in December, was going to take sanctuary if not for, for that stay. So because I'd written about this church twice, I kind of thought, and seeing now that this couple would be staying there longer, I thought I really wanted to go in depth and to see, you know, what does it mean to be taking sanctuary in a church? I just, after this initial press conference, there's just so many questions, you know, where are they sleeping? How are they getting their food? What are they eating? You know, how do you shower? What do you do during the day? Because this couple, you know, they'd been working 7 days a week since they bought the pizza place in November, and they're going from working 7 days a week to now just having very little to do during the day. They're just in the walls of this church. And it's really interesting, too, because the inverse is true for the church volunteers, the people who are helping out the family. They've now added more to their life, and some of them are really energized to be contributing and to be, you know, feeling like they're making a difference. So I just wanted to see more from the perspective of the couple, what their, Malik and Zahida, what their life is like right now, and then also the perspective of the church of what is your life now, like now being a sanctuary congregation, and you know, what does that entail? What is all the planning and the effort that goes into this? And I think also just from reading some of the comments from the first story I wrote, I think a lot of people have a lot of questions, and so I wanted to answer some of the questions and also make sure there's not misinformation out there, because, I mean, it is a topic that people feel really strongly about. And so it was interesting talking to the senior minister of the church, Stephen Jungkite, about why they were doing this. And his view, you know, some people say, oh, what you're doing is illegal. And his view is, well, we view it as allowing the legal process to unfold. Because as Malik and Zahida are in the church, their attorney, Glenn Formica, longtime immigration attorney, is trying to get the Board of Immigration Appeals to reopen the case. And if that's successful, that's good but for them. But he said if they deny the motion to reopen the case, he's going to appeal to the Second Circuit. And both in talking to the attorney, Glenn Formica, and with a spokesperson from the Bureau of Immigration Appeals, it's really unclear how long it will take to decide whether to reopen the case. There's really a lot of different factors there. So it's, you know, Malik and Zahida are just kind of in limbo now, not sure what's going to happen or when. And so it's interesting to see how this progresses. And you know, I'd been talking about how it's tough, you know, what do you do to fill the day? The church has been trying to do some different activities, whether it's drumming or embroidery or pottery, and there's already a sewing group every week. So, you know, at the end of one of the meetings, someone came in and said to Zahida, you know, oh, join our sewing group next week. But other than that, you know, when their daughter's there, they'll read books to her. She's played tag with the senior minister's children at the church, and we'll kind of play classroom with her parents as the pupils, and she'll be teaching her parents. And then when she's not there, you know, Malik and Zahida will maybe read stuff on their phone. They'll pray, do a little bit of cooking. Malik really likes watching cricket. So it's a very different life. And I think what inspired me to write this story was just how unique it was for this area that, you know, other than Mara Narcodoso staying there for one night, this church hasn't offered sanctuary before. You know, this is the first time they've done this long term. I'm not familiar with it happening at other churches in this region, though I admittedly haven't been in the paper for terribly long. But yeah, I think most people don't know someone who's facing deportation, or don't know someone who's taking sanctuary in a church, or don't know someone who's maybe volunteering at the church. So I think it's kind of an untold story, and I just thought it'd be something really interesting and different for us to look into and go more in depth.
Thank you for listening, and make sure to visit theday.com to find the stories mentioned in this episode.